Therapy Insiders is brought to you by Verve, makers of the Arc, a revolutionary neck pain relief and postural support device, available now at www.goarcnow.com, and by Edge Mobility System. Give your mobility the edge. Available at www.edgemobilitysystem.com.
Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Chirac-Abrod here with Dr. Joe Palmer, Dr. Barton Bishop, and our special guest, back after a year hiatus, making her triumphant return, Stefania Bell, the one and only ESPN injury analyst. And by one and only, I mean the one and only that I actually bothered to read because it's worthwhile reading. How's everyone doing today?
Doing good,
wow. Team. After that intro, I feel very special.
That was all in one breath, too, which is even more impressive, I think. So, it's right around springtime, at least in terms of the date.
No, it's not.
I don't know about where you are, but it's been in the negative degrees here for seems like forever. But baseball season's right around, at least that's what Twitter tells me. And I'm guessing you have a trip coming up to check out some spring training sites?
Yes, it's imminent. I will be going to Arizona and running around from one team to the next, and then going to Florida and doing the same thing. So this is my chance to get on the road and check out all the guys who are coming back from injury and see how they look in the spring.
And when you say run around, I think you actually quite literally mean you're going to be running around based on what you've told us. So when you get to spring training and you're checking out all the players warming up and getting back into the swing of things, what are you looking for? Are you looking at past injuries? Are you talking to the trainers? Are you talking to the players? What's your system of kind of getting a feel for what the guys are going through?
Well, you know, you find out as you go. Obviously, you know, as PT, the observational skills are important. And so if I know in advance what guys are coming back from, and I've done a lot of homework because, as you know, I'm involved with our fantasy sports, and fantasy baseball is getting ready to launch. So we have meetings. In fact, we've just been finishing them up here, where we go through all the players and they're ranking them for the preseason. So I do a lot of homework in advance. And
so you're scouting.
I'm looking back at what happened during the year. How did they end the season? Did they end it with an injury? Is there something they dealt with? A lot of these guys have surgery in the offseason, and you may not even have known that they were going to when the season ended. So it's kind of recapping from where they are to where they are in the spring, and then looking to see how they look as the season approaches. You know, sometimes you hear, he's healthy, no problem by opening day. But then when you get out there, you find out, well, you know, maybe it's not going as well, or they're slowing him down a little bit, or vice versa. And then the other thing that's really important is talking to the players and the managers, different position coaches, because I love to hear from the players. And it's interesting, when I first started doing this, I didn't know how they would feel about talking to me about their injuries. But what I found is that when they find out I'm a PT, and over the years now I've gotten to know some of them. So they kind of, a lot of the baseball players, by the way, play fantasy football. So if they felt like I was helpful at all, it does.
So they need your advice.
I get there.
You. Is this guy going to play this week or not?
Actually, you'd be surprised. There are some baseball players who either join us on the podcast during fantasy football season, or we exchange information. So when I get there for the spring, you know, they'll talk because they know I understand the language that they're speaking about, what they've been through, and how they're coming back and how they're feeling. And so I like hearing from the players, and I find they're pretty straightforward. Some of them don't want to talk about it. They really just want it behind them. But I find that most of them, because they know I'm familiar with the injury or I understand the rehab process, they are really glad to talk to someone who actually understands it all.
Do you find that because they understand, or you understand the lingo, that they not only open up, but they kind of ask your advice and see what you think about going forward? And on the same side, are other trainers or coaches kind of asking for the same thing, just your thought or how the player is doing, maybe compared to another team? Do you ever get that, those kinds of questions?
Not from anyone who's in a management position, really. I think that the players are sometimes interested. They'll say, you know, how does that sound compared to what you've seen? Or, you know, sometimes they do want my opinion on their progress relative to other athletes who've been through the same thing. But not usually. You know, it's an interesting line because I am still the media and reporting on it. So, and I'm not trying to interfere with their regimen that they've got going on with the team. So right. It's not like I'm doling out advice while I'm there. But I think just the familiarity and the banter that we can have. But I'll give you an example. When I was at Red Sox camp, not the last year, but the year before, Mike Napoli had just been diagnosed with avascular necrosis in his hip. So he plays for the Red Sox, for right. those who don't know. And there was a lot of panic about whether he was going to pass the physical and all of this business. And he ended up being treated at a hospital for special surgery by someone who specializes in metabolic conditions, metabolic bone conditions and what have you. And he got on a really good plan. And essentially, and this has all been reported, so I'm not telling anything out of school, but he was on almost a program similar to what somebody who has osteoporosis would be on. And he ended up doing really, really well. And when I came back a year later, which was last year, and we talked about it, I had made some comment. One of the medications he was taking, I remembered it was something where you couldn't lie down for a while afterward. And he was like, oh my God, remember you said that? Like, he knew the fact that I knew that about the medication, like, bonded us. And he wanted to show me the picture of how the little prescription came with the picture of the guy not lying down. And, you know, it's just little things like that. But
so you build up that repertoire and that trust based on the knowledge that you shared with him.
Exactly. It's sort of a unique knowledge. You wouldn't expect most reporters to come in and know that angle or that detail. And everybody has their way of making a connection. For me, it's just through that understanding the medical aspect of what they've been through. But it's great because sometimes, especially in a case like his, where it's something that's not as common or people aren't as familiar with it, I think they like sharing the story because they want people to understand, or they want to prove, like in his case, he had an amazing year. If they overcome something, they want people to appreciate, hey, this isn't a sentence that ends your career if you get this diagnosis. There are things you can do. And so I think they actually open up more, and I was pleasantly surprised by that. Now, that's not universal.
Right. Well, but, a few things are usually universal.
Yeah.
So when you – and I've been wondering about this since we've talked last time. As you go through the camps, and obviously you're active in our physical therapy field, and you go to conferences and you meet a lot of clinicians, and I'm sure you hear about a lot of the topics that are happening in the field. As you go through camps and talk with the players or the trainers or maybe even their treating physicians, do you see, as some of the new advancements in the field happen, trickle to the professional level, or does it kind of get to the professional level first? You know, there's always that divisive line between very evidence-based practice type of clinicians and manual therapy, which doesn't always have a ton of grade A evidence behind it. But I've read stories from you about, you know, dry needling or being integrated or manual therapy techniques. I know some chiropractors are there. Do you see that parallel between as we evolve and as some of the stuff that goes on in their training rooms?
I do. I think that actually in the therapy side, it's probably as progressive as anywhere. When you look at the surgery side, it tends to be a little more conservative. And again, I'm speaking in generalities, but the first place, and you can appreciate why this would be the case, but if in surgery, if they're trying a new technique or they're trying some modification of something that's been around or a different approach or a different tool, the pro athlete is probably not going to be the first place you try it out. And you can understand why that would be the case, because they want to establish a pattern of clinical success before they use it on
their multi-million dollar investment.
And that's understandable. It can be a very, you know, these are environments where people, you know, there's a lot of liability and, you know, there are big issues going on there. And I think so sometimes in surgery, you'll see things that are happening a little bit more progressively outside of that realm, and then they catch on later, or they adopt something, I should say, later. But on the rehab side, I think as clinicians go out and they're taking courses or they're trying new things or they're talking to their colleagues or going to conferences, I think they tend to be more progressive. And certainly the communities of the rehab personnel from various teams within a league, I think are very tight. You know, mm-hmm. They have the associations that link all the medical staffs, for example, within the NFL. So they have, like, I was just at the combine at Indy, and they have presentation. They have a scientific meeting one night during the combine, and it's a meeting that's a closed door meeting. I'm not allowed to go, which is really too bad because I'd like to, but it's a closed door meeting, and they have the team physicians and all the rehab staff are present, and they have they present different things. They present abstracts in advance of being submitted for publication if one group is studying something or looking at something, and they share ideas and thoughts and best practices based on the very specific population that they treat. So I think you know, there's a lot of that communication that goes on. But on the rehab side, I certainly hear about people trying things, you know, dry needling, you brought that up. It's not everyone in the PT community is doing it, but I certainly hear about it quite a bit amongst the pro athletes. And I think if you understand the mentality of the athletes, is that they'll try anything to get better, right? Because being sidelined means they're not working, they're not getting paid, it could threaten their next contract. You know, they need to be playing. So if they don't feel they're getting success with traditional things, they're going to look elsewhere. And that's a double-edged sword, because they're not necessarily the most discriminating when it comes to choosing who might be treating them or what they're using. But if they know somebody else has had success with it and they're struggling to get better, they're going to try it. So I think if in the right hands, that's a positive, because if you're a PT who's well-trained, you can be very progressive in that environment.
Are they restricted to just their training and rehab staff, or players, do they have
absolutely
the ability?
Absolutely not. No, it's their right to seek treatment outside. It may not be, you know, now certainly when they go, like, for example, you know, there are things that are in the collective bargaining agreements for the different leagues that dictate how some of those things happen. But you hear all the time about athletes who, you know, have a therapist on the side or somebody who they pay to travel with them in some cases. Somebody.
I remember I read the story about Kobe Bryant.
A
few months ago. Yeah.
She now works for the Lakers, but for a long time she... specifically, he would fly her places because she's a very talented therapist, and you know, he wanted that available to him. Like I said, it cuts both ways, because they'll try anything, and it's not like the athletes are always the most discriminating in terms of, is this really proven to work, or is this something, you know, are there risks involved? you don't always know where they're getting their information. But I would say even amongst the different staffs in various leagues, I know quite a few people who are on the medical staffs in various leagues, and there are some excellent physical therapists in particular who I know. And I can assure you that there are a number of folks who are getting very progressive treatment.
So each professional team carries their own staff, as we've been talking about, right? Which usually consists of athletic trainers, physical therapists, sometimes chiropractors. I'm sure there's some have acupuncturists, dietitians. When you go through different camps, whether it's baseball or football, do you feel there's a one of the sports maybe is really pushing the boundaries of something, or are they all kind of on the equal playing field of what it takes to get their athletes back? Because I feel like when I watch baseball, they're still maybe not quite as advanced in terms of the latest as football. I still see a bunch of them sitting around stretching, and whereas watch, you know, football warmups, I see the dynamic warmups. It might just be what I see based on what's available. But what do you think when you go around, you go, do you ever see, you go, why are you doing that? And do you ever say that? What are you doing?
Now, I have to work in these environments. So, you know, and it's also hard. And to be fair, in defense of everyone who's on the team side, you know, when you float in for a day or a few hours, you're not really privy to all that's going on. So it's really hard to make a judgment or an assessment. Even as a PT, from my position, I'm not sitting there embedded with the team for weeks at a time and watching everything that they do. But you do pick up hints of things based on what the players will tell you, or people that you know who are on the staff and you know their backgrounds and what kind of things they're providing. But they have to work within the constraints of what they can do as a team. I mean, I've for the longest time, and I say it on my podcast all the time, I wish in Major League Baseball that you would see the stationary bikes lined up before these guys would go up to hit, especially when they start. And this year in particular, I cannot imagine that when opening day rolls around, it's going to be snow free around the country. So these guys are playing in cold temps. You're waiting for your at bat. You're usually sitting in the dugout,
and then
they get up, they swing, and most hamstring injuries. And this was published and presented. I think Chris Ahmad, the New York Yankees team doctor, is the lead author on this. But looking at hamstring strains in Major League Baseball players, and the majority happen going from the batter's box to first base.
You know, TheraBand, and there's a bunch of different brands of them, but TheraBand has a massage roller massager, like the stick and all those, the tiger tail and all those different self-myofascial release instruments. And one of the things that some researchers in Canada did, Dwayne Button specifically in his group at Memorial University in Newfoundland, did some research looking at using a roller massager on gastrocs, hamstrings, quads, 6 seconds each muscle group. And what they found was that there was a significant increase in the range of motion of the muscle, but there was no change in muscle performance. So the body was able to still have as much sprinting speed, have as much jumping ability. They looked at all of the force outputs that you normally see degrade with a low load static long held stretch. But so what you get is you get this increased extensibility and you get no change of performance. And when we heard about this research, we're sitting around talking about it at TheraBand's Research Advisory Committee annual meeting, and we immediately went to baseball and thinking, what would happen if these guys were in the dugout and they just, you know, did 6 seconds on each leg, three different muscle groups. It takes 36 seconds to do it right before they go up to bat, and would that make an impact on hoping or helping to decrease hamstring strains? And something simple like that could help.
Well, you know, these are the things that you would love to try. Now, it gets hard in the pros because especially baseball where everybody's so much creatures of habit and you're talking about changing anything in that environment is very, very difficult. But this is where it's good to have minor leagues. A lot of times this is where these things get tested. You know,
we're also known as test dummies.
Guinea pigs. Yeah.
But I mean, it's true. I mean, these are the kind of things that need to get tested to see what we can do. I mean, it's just, you think about baseball, how long they've been doing the same thing where they're in the dugout and they come up to hit and they swing the weighted bat sometimes. And there's that whole
topic. Because that helps.
Hey, easy now. Do not badmouth the dry swings part.
Well, at least this year, you know, the inning time in between isn't going to be as long.
Pace of play rules
are going to be in effect.
Yeah, got to keep a foot in the batter's box.
People's heads are going to explode.
Keep a foot in the batter's box. but I really, you know, so that's just one example, but I think those are the kind of things I see that, you know, I always wonder, well, what if we could change this? Could we make a difference? And, you know, who knows? But I certainly see, you mentioned the dynamic warm-up that you're seeing with football, and you're seeing a lot of guys do these things. You are seeing some changes being implemented. It just takes a while for it to happen.
So you mean you don't run out in the field in the middle of the field going, what the hell are you doing? Do you know what you're doing? No? Doesn't happen now?
No, okay. I sit quietly in the background because I don't want to be banned from the facility. And, you know, and I don't want to make it sound like everybody's doing, you know.
Right.
There's a lot of good things that are going on. Trust me. There's a lot of really good people who are out there, but it's tough to change a culture. You're talking about changing entire cultures sometimes. So it also depends on the organization. You got to remember when you have a team, you've got, in the case of baseball, you know, managers, in the case of football, coaching staffs, these things get switched out quickly. You know, they have a bad season. Look at football, how many coaching staffs get swapped out. And that means the medical staffs, who tend to be the most consistent, by the way, of anything in there, because players are changing and coaching staffs are changing. Medical staffs can be fairly consistent. But if you get a coaching regime in there that's got very different philosophies, it can make the job of the medical staff more challenging. It's not as easy as you might think.
How much autonomy does the medical staff have? If they make a medical recommendation, is it final, or does the coach still have the say based on what they say?
No, I mean, medical staff certainly has the authority, particularly in football. They have the authority, and I say particularly in football because, you know, there's been so much attention to this of who makes the decision. Guys do not return to the game from injury. Guys do not play on the weekend. If the medical staff says they can't play, it's a medical decision. And really, I think that's pretty universally accepted in the sense that it's not contested by the coaching staffs anymore. They may not like it all the time. Guy looks fine to them, but if the medical staff is saying they can't participate, they don't. And I think what's well established now is certainly in the area of concussions and things of that nature. If medical personnel is saying a player needs to be removed, coaches are not really arguing that anymore.
Yeah, how much do you know about the concussion protocol, Stefania? Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. In which sport? Football?
Football, yeah.
Yeah, so there is a concern about a player, and you've got, there's a few things going on now. They've added the eye in the sky. That's an athletic trainer who's up in the booth who is watching the field and has the ability to phone down, communicate with the sideline if they observe a player behaving like they are exhibiting signs of a head injury. And they also can receive a communication from someone on the sideline who, if they are asking them to look at, you know, if they saw something. So the way it's set up is that there's no bias, because you can't have one team suggesting that you look at another team's player. Right?
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Because then you could be like, hey, you should remove that guy over there, the opponent. So it's set up so that will not happen. But the point is, the eye in the sky is another set of eyes besides the people who are down on the sideline. And when the player comes out, there's a sideline assessment that's performed that is fairly basic, but involves a series of questions of the player. And you have not only the team physician there, but you have this independent neurological consultant. So somebody who is not affiliated with the team in any way. This is a neurologist who has experience with sports-related concussion, who is contracted basically with the NFL, not the team. So they're there on the sideline. You have one on each sideline. And so they can gather around the player, and sometimes the team will also have a team neurologist or somebody who has a neurological background who's there also to help out. And in any event, they go through a sideline exam that consists of basic assessment, maybe a quick neuro screen, maybe a quick upper quarter screen if they're also checking for musculoskeletal things, maybe a couple quick visual tests and some Q&A. And if there's anything there that makes them suspicious, then they take them to the locker room and do what they call the head-to-toe exam. So it's much more complete. It's where they do the computerized testing, and it's really the more complete concussion evaluation, if you will. So if on the sideline everything passes, they can allow the player to return to play. But the complete eval, if they take them to the locker room, that's a longer test, more on the order of 10 to 15 minutes. So that's what happens. Players can return even after they've been taken to the locker room for evaluation if they pass everything successfully. But if they don't, then obviously they're removed, and then they follow. If they've been determined to have a concussion, there is a protocol that they have to follow to get back, which essentially the main components of it are that they have to be symptom-free and sign-free at rest. Their neurocognitive status, they'll take follow-up impact tests. They have to return to baseline. They have to go through progressive activity. You know, as they improve with no symptoms at rest, they can add light exertion. If they get through that without recurrence of symptoms, they go into heavier things, football-related activity. If they go through that, then they have to be cleared by the independent neurological consultant before they can return to play or to contact. And some teams have it like a contact test specifically that they will do. And every team has their own sort of exercises or activities that fall within those realms. But basically, that's the criteria.
So it sounds like they've gotten a lot more thorough based on probably the outcry and the lawsuits and the natural progression of player safety with concussions. Have you heard of any more technological progress or looking into it? I know there have been testing sensors in the helmet, kind of force sensors that show, you know, if they make hard enough contact, that pretty much guarantees a concussion, anything like that?
Well, there are a lot of things that are being tested now. I will say this about the league. I mean, there's a lot of money going towards research. And that's something that's really been the focus for the last few years. So there are all different kinds of things that are being looked at. And some of those have to do with, you know, whether there are markers in the blood, you know, would there be a quick blood test, a finger prick, something they could do that would be able, you know, fairly quickly to determine based on some marker in the blood whether you had had a concussive event or not. So they're looking at things like that as from the evaluation standpoint. They're always looking at trying to make equipment safer and things on the prevention side, although what they found so far is that really there hasn't been anything that's been shown to prevent a concussion, as I'm sure you know.
Right.
But education, at least at the younger athlete level, seems to be making a difference. There was a study that in USA Football just reported, there was a press release recently, a study looking at USA Football coaches who had gone through this education program. And in those leagues, the injury rate was substantially lower for kids, where they were doing the education and awareness about concussions and the heads up tackling program and so on. So I think there's a lot of different areas in concussion evaluation and management that are being looked at, but nothing really definitive has come out in terms of what we're seeing as far as a rule change or a pattern change.
But it's nice to see the NFL making that effort and at least making it more of a public effort, because the NFL is a small portion, albeit the biggest and more most financial, but the high school, the Pop Warner, that's just everywhere, is obviously what really benefits from all this when the kids can really know.
And frankly, that's where, you know, for me, that's where the most important, I mean, the pros get well looked after and well taken care of. Yes, they're in the sport where, you know, the collisions are the most violent and they're perhaps at significant risk, but they're adults who are choosing to do that. And they are being well looked after. But for at the youth level in particular, I think the trickle-down effect from a lot of the education and awareness is what's important. And the benefits of that research, as you said, will carry over to that group. And that's hopefully where we'll see those benefits play out in the next few years.
So speaking about blood and research, I recently read an article from you about blood flow restriction and the Texans implementing this new, I guess, called rehab or
training.
Can you give us a little elaboration on that or synopsis? Or I'm running out of fancy synonyms to call it.
No, it would be a synopsis because the science guy is really Johnny Owens, who's a PT at the Center for the Intrepid at Brooke Army Medical Center. Very bright guy, makes me really proud to be a PT, and very science-minded, very basic science-minded. And it was his investigation into alternate forms of strengthening for some of the wounded warriors that they were treating at their facility, where they were not able to make strength gains using traditional methods. And, you know, the consequences for those patients was losing a limb. And so Johnny was really racking his brain and trying to come up with something that would allow them to strengthen in some sort of alternate way than what we conventionally are used to. And he came across in the literature this blood flow restriction training. A lot of the early science is out of Japan, and I believe it's been about 20 years that this has been being documented and studied, and there were some additional studies in Europe. And so he started contacting some of the researchers who were involved in this, and based on what he learned about it, he felt like it was something that they should try. So they began using it on some of their population. They saw great results early on, and so they started engaging in some clinical trials within their own facility, the results of which were pretty impressive. And we visited them for Veterans Day coverage in November, and I wrote a story on it at that time and said this might have application at the professional athlete level. And it got the attention of the NFL, and next thing you know, one team in particular, the Houston Texans, wanted to learn more about it and then ultimately decided to try it out with some of their players. So the basic premise is that you use a tourniquet, and Johnny has worked with Delphi, who manufactures pretty much all the surgical tourniquets you would see in the OR. And worked with them to develop a tourniquet that would function under these parameters, where you partially occlude blood flow to the limbs. You're not completely cutting it off, but partial occlusion. These tourniquets are now being embedded with Doppler sensors so they can continually monitor pressures, because as you exercise, of course, those things can change. But the idea is to then exercise the limb with the tourniquet pressure applied. But the resistance is very low load, because you don't have to work at a high load with this blood flow restriction going on.
So is the thought to increase capillary density with decreased blood flow?
It's actually this global systemic response. And it gets a little too advanced Krebs cycle for me, but which is why you should really have Johnny on, because you guys can get all the science that you want. But it essentially stimulates in the brain the release. Your body goes into feeling like there's an oxygen demand because you are it's recognizing that there's some sort of oxygen deprivation going on. So it stimulates a number of things, but in one of the byproducts is the release of human growth hormone. And so what they're seeing is these massive strength gains with very low intensity work. And that's what they really needed for these wounded warriors. And if you think about athletes who've undergone microfracture or other procedures where you have limited weight bearing and you can't strengthen in conventionally, this allows them a means of strengthening with a very low load that doesn't threaten the healing process of the other tissue. And so that's where the athlete interest, the rehabbing athlete interest is anyway.
That's very interesting. Quick disclaimer for anyone listening, our physical therapy listeners, please do not try to tourniquet yourselves and start exercising. Read the research first. I know it sounds like a really cool technique, but let's keep your limbs for now.
And your patient's limbs.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, by all means. I mean, you know, this is one of the things that I have to say, you know, in talking to Johnny, one of the things that really impressed me, they were doing this and studying this at Brook Army Medical Center for some time before they ever were going to share it publicly, because he wanted to be really sure that, A, they were legitimately getting the results that they were. So they wanted to measure it and document it and study it and have a control group and all those things. But he has several grants. There's they just received a grant, an NIH grant, multi-center clinical trial looking at post-femur fractures in various populations. So there are a lot of potential applications for this. And he's certainly going about studying it the right way. But the tourniquets are not yet available. They're working on final clearance through the FDA because they really wanted to get this done the right way. I mean, this is going to be FDA approved as a medical device. And the tourniquets are being specially created so that they have, as I said, a Doppler embedded in them so they can monitor pressures. They will have shutoff valves. There are going to be all kinds of safety features built into it. So it's not just a matter of like taking a loop of TheraBand and tying it around your leg and occluding blood flow.
Don't give people suggestions.
Oh, no, I don't have to, because I'm telling you that people have already done this.
I was already using my belt.
Johnny and I were both, you know, he presented at the Combine to all the medical personnel there. They invited him to speak based on the story we did in November. And he and I were talking about this and saying that he I think he said his wife had been on Amazon.com, and he's like, look at this. And it had since been removed, but it was like a picture of a guy with a big bicep. All you saw was the arm, and it had this strap around it. And at the top, it said blood flow restriction training. And it was like suggesting this belt for purchase. Wow. And I think, I can't remember how much it cost, but it said, if you like this, you know, one of those, if you like this, you might also like.
Yeah.
And it directed you to mattresses. And the reason it directed you there is because that belt was the same belt that was like one of those mattress straps, you know?
Naturally.
Oh. And so, yes, people will do things that are crazy and inappropriate. And, you know, but they do that with other stuff that we already have.
Oh, that's available for sure.
So, yes, you worry about the potential for that, but certainly when the tourniquets become commercially available, I think you're going to see the opportunity for proper training and certification and using them.
Sounds like he's doing it the right way. He's
absolutely
going through the entire process properly and being fairly conservative with it. And it sounds definitely interesting. I'll reach out to Johnny, see if we can chat with him and get more info on it. But it's considering everything we have out there now, you know, why not shed some more light on an up and coming possible technique that who knows might be a mainstay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think that I actually tried it, by the way. So I went down to San Antonio to see what they were doing, and I put one of the tourniquets on. Well, I didn't put it on, but I had them do it and measure it. And that, you know, it feels a little strange because it's like you're getting that blood pressure cuff. Mm.
So is that why you have the guns that you have now?
Yeah. We're going to need a picture of your bicep for the website.
Just to be clear, I did it on my leg.
Pickler didn't happen.
And I was a little nervous because I knew it was uncomfortable. I mean, this is not, it's not a comfortable technique, but they were telling me it's not terrible. It's just not fun. And I'm thinking, well, you know, this is all a matter of who's doing it, right?
So it sounds very much like dry needling. It's almost say the same thing to the person. It's not comfortable, but it's not that bad.
Once I started,
it's not going to hurt me at all.
Exactly. Right. Well, exactly.
And I say that all the time.
So they put it on and it got that, you know, kind of that feeling that I don't really like when the blood pressure cuff is getting almost as tight as.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Put it. And then they leave it once it gets to that point, and I think it's about 80% occlusion, if I remember correctly, of blood flow to my leg. Then I began a leg press. But instead of doing a leg press with a high weight, like what you would normally do if you were just at the gym and you were trying to build strength and you were doing a lot of resistance.
600 pounds.
Something like that. Yeah. I think there was just one or two itty bitty plates that like you would think I could do that. You could do this in your sleep. It's like nothing. Like you would make the weight fly. And I'm telling you, after doing one set, I was feeling a little fatigued. After two sets, I was sweating and like feeling exhausted, like I had just sprinted.
Did they put it mid-belly of your quadriceps?
It's pretty proximal. Okay. You know, close to the...
So you get as much fibers as possible involved?
Yeah. So, I mean, that whole experience, I think it's sort of surreal to see yourself doing very lightweight, next to nothing, and having this systemic response of like, whoa, I feel like I'm working out so hard.
So it was on one quad and it was on one leg.
It was on one hip and I just did a single leg press. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. And that's what proved to me that it was a systemic response because normally you wouldn't crack a sweat at all, just, you know, moving that weight. So
very interesting. Yeah, we'll have to reach out to Johnny and see if we can get him on and talk a little bit more about it. Sounds pretty cool. I think we should call it at that before we get the wrath of Stefania as she has to run for her plane. So thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
No wrath here.
No wrath?
No wrath here.
The grapes
like I
of
said,
wrath.
I'm all about the positive energy. I like have it. No wrath.
You spend a lot of time in California. That's why you give off those California vibes.
No, and you know what? Wrath will come with snow. That will. Well, I spent a lot of time in Connecticut, and
plenty
there's
of it here.
Way too much snow this year. So,
amen to that. So, thanks a lot for joining us. A lot of great info. It's always insightful and fun chatting with you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Stefania.
Yeah, thank you, Stefania.
So if you haven't read the article yet, go ahead, check out the Blood Flow Restrictions by Stefania Bell on ESPN.com. You can just search for it. It pops right up. It's definitely an interesting read, and we'll try to get Johnny on and talk a little bit more about it. So good luck in spring training. Hope you have fun. Enjoy the warm weather, and go O's.
Safe travels.
Thank you.